Welcome to Audio Notes. I'm Nikki Sweat, your host. On this session, we'll be going for a stroll in romantic twilight, with music from the latter part of the 19th century that will appear on the Menlo concert on Thursday, July 27th. The program begins with relatively light numbers, miniatures by Gabriel Fauré. Then it goes on to probe the passions and tensions of late Romanticism with major selections by Tchaikovsky, Dvorak, and Johannes Brahms. When Gabriel Fauré took up a faculty position at the Paris Conservatoire, he was regularly tapped to contribute compositions to internal competitions and external exams. These would include set pieces that auditioners would prepare beforehand, and also little morsels that competitors would have to perform at sight. It was for an admissions exam in 1903 that Fauré composed his short sight-reading piece for violin and piano. It's a simple tune which need not be played too quickly. Naturally, there are a few moments that require quick thinking and make sure that potential entrants were practicing their scales and arpeggios. Though necessarily facile, it comes off as a lovely miniature which explores all of the violin's potential to sing sweetly. This is a form that Fauré excelled at producing. His record of success with short character pieces went back decades. For example, the Berceuse that he wrote in 1880 for a performance of the Société Nationale de Musique completely took off. It became a standard not just for the violin, but for just about every instrument that would appear in concerts. The gently rocking melody is just a bit too seductive to actually make us sleepy. While the slightly melancholic contrasting passage in the middle of the piece stirs a strong romantic sentiment. He keeps us on our toes harmonically until the very end, so we can sustain the balance of tender nostalgia and youthful optimism that's a marker of many late romantic pieces, small and large. Composers rarely know which of their creations will really take off in this way. Pyotr Ilyich Tchaikovsky could not have imagined the life that his stunning Andante Cantabile would come to have as a standalone concert work. The piece started as the slow movement of his first string quartet. According to the remembrances of his friend Nikolai Kashkin, Tchaikovsky heard a folk tune whistled by a plasterer and used that tune as the basis for this beloved Andante, which would be arranged for a number of different solo and string combinations, including the composer's own 1888 rendition for cello and string ensemble. The cellist Nicholas Kanellakis told me more about what makes this short piece so special.
The Tchaikovsky Andante Cantabile certainly is a very popular piece of Tchaikovsky's. It exists in kind of two forms, right? The original, which is the slow movement of his first string quartet, but possibly even more well known as this arrangement for solo cello and strings. You can always expect Tchaikovsky's writing to just be romantic and beautiful, and it has certainly those qualities. But I think in some ways it's the combination of its beauty with its unbelievable simplicity that makes it just such a memorable piece. The second theme in particular is almost like an aria. There's something operatic about it. It's got this pizzicato accompaniment. The cello really takes the place of a voice. It really becomes a song. The first theme has a little bit more contrapuntal writing with the voices. It's also melodic, but maybe not as much in such a clear, simple song-like way. The second theme has a bit of a lilt to it. There's almost maybe like a song with a dance element to it. Whereas the first theme is extremely sostenuto, sustained. Particularly when the second theme returns back in the home key of B major, somehow that return home makes it even more poignant and more touching. He also brings the dynamic down to pianissimo or even triple piano. And there is this particularly nostalgic quality to when the second theme comes back. And he keeps that sense of introspection and nostalgia all the way to the end of the piece.
In the mid-1870s, Antonin Dvorak was in that gray area between success and fame. For several years, he won financial support from the Austrian State Prize in Composition, which was awarded on the basis of annual portfolios of new compositions. This meant he had to write fast, but also at an extremely high level and with a clear individual voice. His submission in 1876 included a symphony, a string quartet, and also his piano trio in G minor. Nick told me about his experience of coming to Dvorak's music as a young cellist, and he also shared some of the best qualities of Dvorak's writing, which he thinks are well captured in this trio.
I discovered Dvorak very early on. It's a real vivid memory I have of having maybe only been playing the cello for a couple of years, like the age of 9. And I had heard the theme of the Dvorak Cello Concerto once, and then there was a piece on the radio, and I was listening to my dad, and I asked my dad, "What is this piece? What is this piece?" And he said, just wait till the end. And then, of course, the famous theme of the first movement of the Dvorak Concerto comes back at the end. And I said, "Oh, it's Dvorak." And I just always loved that piece so much. It's always meant so much to me. So much other music by Dvorak has that quality that the concerto has. It has incredible cello writing combined with this inimitable romantic voice that's also rooted in the music of his homeland. Tchaikovsky and Dvorak are great melodists. And I think that always lends itself to the cello. That in and of itself makes it cellistic, because cello is a melodic instrument. I think at the end of the day, the cello can be a harmonic instrument, it can be the bass line, but I think it's truly a singing instrument. The violin and the piano are that, plus they're also used as virtuoso instruments. And the cello can be a virtuoso instrument as well, obviously, but I think its true nature is song-like melodies. And so Dvorak knows how to spin a tune. When he gives it to the cello, it just seems to work. Dvorak always gives everyone something great to do. Nobody is ever relegated to just an accompanying role in Dvorak, and that's certainly great for cellists, because sometimes that can happen in cello writing. This Dvorak G minor trio that I'm playing, it's less well known than the F minor trio or the Dumky trio, the E minor trio. It has a little bit more naivete than those trios. But it has just as much charm. and just as much actually beauty. He often writes very folk-inspired music that can be in a minor key, but it's not a tragic minor, it's a folky minor. It's a misconception to think that minor equals tragedy and major equals happy. I think actually someone like Dvorak, I think, cuts against that a little bit. I played the Dvorak Trio in G minor when I was very young. I think I may have only played the first movement. I mean, I'm talking like I must have been 10 or 11. It may be like one of the first real chamber pieces that I learned when I was a student in Manhattan School pre-college. And I have not played it since. So I am really excited to finally play it as a maturer musician. When I listened to it recently, I did remember the tunes from then. It did bring back memories, and I'm curious when I really start to get into it with rehearsing and stuff, how much more is going to be recalled from when I was 11.
Johannes Brahms took a stab at retiring in 1890, but he was so inspired by the playing of the clarinetist Richard Mühlfeld that he jumped back into the fray and wrote four more chamber works, including the autumnal quintet for strings and clarinet. Artistic director David Finkel told me about what these final works meant to Brahms at the very end of his life as a composer.
When we were planning this Romantic Twilight program, it seemed impossible to imagine it without the Brahms Clarinet Quintet. Chronologically speaking, it comes at just the right time in history. He composed it in 1891. He was only 6 years from his death, and it not only marks the end of the 19th century Romantic period, but it also describes perfectly the emotional state in which Brahms was towards the end of his life. The whole piece is a kind of a farewell to the 19th century and the romanticism that Brahms loved. It's a eulogy for that. He knew that modernism was coming. So the whole piece is like a sunset. It's in the very sad key of B minor. That's a key that Bach used for his B minor mass, Dvorak for the cello concerto. The first movement is very long. Everything descends. All the themes, if they rise up at all, they descend in sadness. The second movement, which is in B major, it's as though Brahms is already in heaven, except for a turbulent and very dramatic and folk-like middle section that sounds like improvisation, especially from the clarinet. The third movement, which normally in a classical work would be a scherzo, is kind of more like an intermezzo in D major. It's a little bit of relief from the sadness, almost like a remission of some kind. And it features also a wistful middle section that actually functions like a scherzo in a fleeting B minor. The fourth movement, which is a set of variations on a very somber theme, once again in B minor, really sums up the piece. In this set of variations, almost every human experience is illustrated. But very importantly, at the end of the piece, after the variations are done, Brahms brings back the first movement, and fragments from the first movement's theme have the final say. In some ways, they keep asking the question, why? Like Beethoven's asking, muss es sein, must it be, and at the end of his Opus 135 quartet. And the resolution we get is only really in farewell and death.
Brahms's quintet is the first major entry in this genre in over 100 years, since W.A. Mozart wrote a clarinet quintet in the 1780s. In some ways, Brahms is clearly building his work on Mozart's model, for example, by making the final movement a theme and variations set. But in other ways, Brahms is doing something completely different. I had a conversation with the violinist Stella Chen, where we spoke a little bit about what Brahms does similarly to Mozart and what he does differently, and also about the particular combination of somber reminiscence and tenderness that make this piece a distinctly late Romantic statement.
Every theme has this hint of nostalgia, but also just the most tenderness that I could imagine.
Mm-hmm.
It has this lullaby quality, this kind of rocking quality. The way that the clarinet emerges out of the texture at the very opening of the first movement is so special, because I would never say that the strings are playing something accompanimental at the beginning, right? It's something beautiful and melodic in its own right. Yet, on top of that, then the clarinet comes in as a soloist. There are moments where the clarinet is clearly a solo instrument on top of a full-on orchestra, like in the second movement and during the stormy parts. When I first heard the second movement, I was completely shocked that the middle section was Brahms. I just couldn't believe that he could envision and allow for this kind of rubato. I keep mentioning this tender quality and this idea of a lullaby, and there's something very dreamlike about the outer sections. And then the middle section is sort of like a nightmare, honestly. There's just such a clear narrative arc to me. And it goes from this lullaby to a nightmare to everything's gonna be okay. But with late Brahms, you know, everything's not quite okay. Like, you know that something's going on the whole time. In the third movement, the 16th notes have got to be a little scrambling, but not in a chaotic way. And actually, with the dotted rhythm, there's this feeling of being unsettled. The beginning of the Andantino has an innocence about it. And it's also not too slow, right? The slow is not too slow and the fast is not too fast. And there's just this feeling of a brook almost where it goes along, but it's not like slamming you in the face at any moment. The fourth movement of the Mozart, for the most part, are sort of variations on something positive, happy, and all of these are variations on something melancholy. There's so much movement, not only in tempo, but between the voices. There are so many variations with a stirring rhythmic motive. Whether that's the syncopated thing or a rocking 3/8 thing. I think that would be my favorite variation before the end, which is just unbelievable how much silence there is. It's really difficult to pull off as a performer, but also just so spectacular when it's done right.
Audio notes are written and produced by Nikki Sweat in consultation with David Finkel and Wu Han. Many thanks to David Finkel, Stella Chen, and Nicholas Kanellakis for speaking with me on this session. Audio excerpts are courtesy of the following artists and organizations. Gabriel Fauré's short sight reading piece for violin and piano is from a Deutsche Grammophon record called Belle Epoque, played by Daniel Hope on violin and Simon Crawford Phillips on piano. Fauré's Berceuse for violin and piano, Opus 16, is from a Sono Luminous album called Virtuoso, a treasury of favorite violin encores. It was played by Jamie Laredo and Margot Garrett. Tchaikovsky's Andante Cantabile for solo cello and strings was from a Chamber Music Society performance. Nicholas Kanellakis was the soloist, together with Cho Lang Lin and Alexi Kenny on violin, Misha Amory on viola, and David Finkel on cello. Dvorak's Piano Trio in G Minor, Opus 26, was likewise from a Chamber Music Society performance. The artists were Gloria Chen on piano, Nicholas Dautrycourt on violin, and Nicholas Alstadt on cello. And finally, Brahms's Clarinet Quintet in B Minor, Opus 115, was from a Music at Menlo Live album. Annie Kovafian was the violinist, Yura Lee was the violist, Philip Setzer also played violin, Paul Watkins was playing cello, and David Schifrin was the clarinetist. Audio notes are a copyrighted production of Music at Menlo.